Welcome, podcast listeners, to the Adventure Slate podcast, where we speak adventure. Happy summertime. Well, almost, I guess, almost formally summer. Hello, Aaron.
Hello. Yes, I guess almost. I mean, it feels like summer once the sun stays up past 8 p.m., no matter what month it is. So
that's true.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. What you got?
Well, speaking of summer, summer always reminds me of things just getting hotter. And that's certainly, I feel, true with what we've got going on. It's kind of exciting. Taking a couple months to kind of reestablish our position like we talked about in other situations. But now kind of finally feeling like we've got a good direction. We've got a good thing going in terms of our intent and everything that we've been planning. And so I'm excited for this ramp up that the summer promises.
That's a good segue. Yeah. Yes, as we tend to do, we do stay on track for the most part, and we are moving right into that that time of adventure slang busyness, which we mean lots going on, and as you said, it's good stuff. So let's talk about that stuff. We're going to do a little bit of a different format this episode. Instead of having a special guest, we are going to be our own guests and talk about what New of Arden is, perhaps what it isn't, and maybe we'll get a little bit into what it has become in the time since we started devising this, and also talking a little bit about, you know, what is game design for us and things like that. So we hope everyone will stay with us and find that interesting as you get a bit of an in-depth analysis or review of game design and of the world of New of Arden.
Well said.
Thank you. So we have talked a little bit about in the past our background, our history with gaming, but I think that there's more to explore there. And the value of that analysis is that this is how we arrived at New of Arden, or how New of Arden and other game ideas and settings, things that are part of tabletop and role-play gaming have developed for us as players, as people. I had a question for you as kind of a starting point.
Yeah.
Because I know your history. I know it probably as well as anybody does, but maybe not. So I'm curious what your first TTRPG memory is. Like your very first one, if you can pinpoint it.
That is a good question. My very first TTRPG memory. It was definitely when I was playing Strider in Gamma World. Strider, yeah, the human fighter. I don't really hardly remember anything other than he kind of had a grumpy attitude. He had a short sword that I remember being terrible. Like I just could never land a hit with it. I did a few times, but it was really uncommon. But he also had like a slug shooter gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that thing was powerful. That thing I'd decimate things with is what I remember as a kid. I don't remember how powerful it actually was or really how what it did.
I think that's a slug thrower in Gamma World lingo.
Basically,
a pistol. Yeah. Yeah. Like a lead bullet kind of pistol.
Yeah. And I remember being really limited on ammo, but I loved using it because it was so effective.
Right.
And I just remember I rolled a 100 because it was like the percentage die. I remember rolling a 100 one time and it was like just completely like. And I got like a critical something. Yeah, I don't know. It was great. I remember that scene. I remember that. I remember like having the minis at the table and like always looking at them. I don't remember when that was. You probably know. You could probably pinpoint like my age or whatever. But that was my first TTRPG memory, is just playing this guy who mostly just kind of walked along with the rest of the party. There was my stepsister at the time had a was playing a like a vine creature, like a piranha plant thing, right?
Okay.
I think a sentient, and then my brother, my older brother, was playing like a tiger person. I think.
Oh yeah.
I don't remember. I don't remember who their characters were, but I remember like they would always, because they were, you know, they're both older than me, so they would do like most of the leading, and I would mostly just launch slugs when it was appropriate, but it was fun. I remember having a lot of fun with it just in that one of those moments.
I honestly don't think you could have been older than 8.
I mean, that sounds about right. I mean, when I look at the kids, you know, my kids right now are 8 and 9. Your grandkids, you know. and you know, I had shown them the D&D starter kit that you got for them just last week, actually, and I feel that kind of level of interest that I remember feeling in those moments. Like, I don't fully grasp it, but I get enough of it to know that it's fun. You know what I mean? And that, like, there's an excitement with, like, the dice and stuff, you know, and I'm still have a lot to figure out, but it was a good experience. So, that wouldn't surprise me.
It sounds like from a child's perspective, there was a lot of fascination with the tools of the game, like the minis, the dice.
Yeah. And, you know, actually I think it was largely the tools that got me into the hobby in general, with board games and tabletop role playing games, because I just remember, like, the difference that it made when, I think you had, like, a couple, like, Cyberpunk figurines. And, you know, I never even played Cyberpunk or the old one, but I could look at the art and I could look at the figurines and I could look at our little grid table and I'm like, oh yeah, I can see it. You know what I mean? Like, they just brought, like, an extra dimension to the experience where it's like, I don't have to just kind of make it up as they go. Like, I'm reading a book, which is totally fine and functional and it has its own value. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I put minis on the table, it's like, oh yeah, you know, we're in the dungeon.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was my first attachment to the game. Like, you know, there's always the dice craze people talk about, miniatures. I mean, I know I bought one or two board games just because of the miniature collection they had.
Yeah.
Like, you know, down the line, I was like, oh man, those minis are so cool. And then the game looks fun. I'll play the game sure. But I mean, I'm with those minis, you know, yeah.
The game is fine, but look at the statues.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man. So yeah. Yeah. And as a kid, I think it does bring a lot, you know, it's easier to conceptualize when you have those, you know, things in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. I do remember having my own, started as an older kid, but the fascination with the dice in particular, they hold a very unique emotion in them.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, they're like, kind of like gems, little gemstones or something.
Yeah.
Some sort of treasure of their own kind. Yeah, so I having the fact that I have a couple of my original dice is also just of tremendous value to me now.
Oh,
so
yeah,
many definitely. Decades later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we go from the adult, me, the parent, what am I going to do with all these kids? Let's entertain them. Let's play a game. Let's play a game I'm interested in. Your kids, here's some dice and some miniatures. And then we're going to put you on an adventure. And if you don't understand it, at least I'm enjoying my time.
That's funny.
History.
Mm-hmm.
That now develops into what is a very formal approach to engaging in game design and world building. We were in a meeting earlier today and we talked about the value of world building and the joy of that discovery.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And also how that kind of, like, because we were talking about earlier, there's, like, two major parts. You know, when you're designing a game, you are world building as if you're writing, like, a novel or fantasy or fiction in general, right? Mm-hmm. Even just storyboarding at times, you know, what the general, you know, world story is. And but on top of it, or maybe underneath it more accurately, you have to create this, like, functional way of operating with those magical dice gems, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they hold the randomness that, you know, can fill in the gaps for you. But you have to figure out how you're going to roll them, you know, what dice you're going to use, what do they mean, you know, how can they interact with each other, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I just kind of want to come back to that because you said something about how, like, the dice have, like, an energy or an emotion of their own. And I totally agree, because when you're building a game, like, you have to figure out how you're going to communicate with the player in the dice rolling aspect, like, if your game has dice. Because, you know, rolling the dice has to be fun. You have to feel some sort of engagement in that one little moment. It happens, you know, over the course of seconds. You grab your dice, you shake them in your hand, you throw them on the table.
Right.
Like, what it means, what it means and how you read the results, you know, it's a whole game of its own.
Well, the rolling of the dice, the act of rolling dice is kinesthetic. So that is a form of engagement and even learning for a lot of people in its
That's
own
good
right.
Point. Yeah.
And it also brings that, it takes care, it creates the simulation that takes care of the, what the determining the outcome of the imagination sort of. So the dice structure, what's possible. And whether, you know, whether or not it succeeds. And we know this, but it's fun to think about why that's important, why that's a necessary part. We've talked about diceless systems before, and I'm not all that familiar with a diceless system. And I'm sure that those systems still have some other way to adjudicate outcomes. But dice are also obviously a very fundamental way of doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, from the game design perspective, like when you think, how am I going to simulate those random factors? How am I going to simulate, this chance of failure or success? You know, how am I going to do that? And, you know, you hear about different systems. People would like to get creative and use things like a deck of cards or like a wheel, you know, like you think of the game of life, right? Has like the wheel you spin in the middle. And it's just like rolling a dice. But but from the game design perspective, you know, that engagement has there's a lot of creativity just in that element, you know? And so we got to figure that out, lay that down, and then we're world building on top of it.
So what would you say is your, in light of that, in light of mechanic and lore, what would you say is most interesting about game design to you?
That's a great question. That's actually a really good question. I feel like from my understanding of the game design so far, one of the things I like about it in general is I get to engage like both sides. You know, I get to be all logical and deductive and, you know, mathematical. And then I can set all of that aside and get completely abstract and creative. And then, you know, they kind of, the tabletop games provide like an arena to mix both. Mm-hmm. So to pick a favorite, there's certainly something satisfying about designing the mechanics, but I think in the tabletop, writing a tabletop role-playing game specifically, I've had more fun designing a world that operates on top of the mechanics. Like the mechanics are great, but until you put that world over it, you know, that's when it all really comes together. I think that's kind of the part that I think I really enjoy because you start to see the whole picture.
That combination.
Yeah, exactly. I don't just see, like, so with New Avarden, you know, so you know that I've written another system in my own time that's just there. and it's a very mechanical system. And I feel like it does a good job doing what it does. And it has, for me, I know that it's like lore, if you will, is very weak. And I'm okay with that for now. But working with New Avarden, which is a narrative game, and there's still a very strong mechanical structure, but it's much more about us, like a facilitating and engaging in a story, at least how I understand it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And so as we built the mechanics in a way, and they are, I mean, I enjoy them. Them are mechanics we've created for it. And seeing how much more, like seeing what the world brings out in those mechanics, you know what I mean? Like it makes the mechanics, like you see how they get used to their potential because of all the details that you associate with them.
Right. Which is that is part of that whole process, is making sure that the mechanics work for, I want to say that they work for the setting, but I don't know that that's necessarily true, because if the mechanics are cohesive, then they should work regardless of the setting, right?
Sure.
But at the same time, there has been a lot of deliberate approach to the way that the mechanics were designed based on how character options, what the goals were, or the outcomes for character options within the setting of New Avarden. And then as the mechanics have solidified, you know, we start to look at how would this work in this setting, how would it work in that setting, which there's variability there. But maybe we're discovering, just as kind of ground level designers, how designing a new system with a new setting works is one way to do it that really works together to inform each half from the other.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good way to say it too. Because, yeah, there is like a certain kind of relationship. Like you said, you know, a lot of systems or most systems who are that are solid in general will stand without the, you know, the fantasy of it, you know, put over it. Like the mechanics will stand regardless of the setting. But they do share an important relationship. I mean, you can even think of like the 5e spinoff, so to speak, of different 5e settings made by fans, you know. And they all ultimately operate the same with the same basic foundation, except, you know, to match the setting, they have to be tweaked in some certain significant ways or reflavored, you know, in simple forms. And when we're creating the new system or an original world and a new system to play it on, then yeah, it's like the system has to make sense by itself, but it also has to have that relationship. And but like you're saying, they do influence each other. And it's like what, like for instance, what it said, what it means to play a character in 5e, and how that relates to the mechanics, you know, we have to build a similar connection.
And I'm trying to imagine what it would take to use the 5e system in the New of Arden setting. It would take a ground level, you know, starting from zero effort
to convert. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but it would take a lot of original writing in terms of, you know, of what our culture is translating those into race and class by their system, you know what I mean? Backgrounds and stuff, and just kind of, yeah, it's definitely, you know, all there. But yeah, because of the way it works mechanically, it would be a whole effort, like you're saying, like from the ground up to make a 5e conversion.
Yeah. So let's talk about what New of Arden is not then. And one thing that it is not is a Vancian-based medieval system. And by Vancian-based, we're talking, of course, about spell slots and memorization and those, you know, quote, limitations derived from popular fiction that have informed a lot of fantasy tropes and fantasy settings and things like that. New of Arden is neither Vancian nor is it medieval.
Right, yes. and nor is it wholesale sci-fi either, which I think is sort of where the brain goes next for me, at least. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, okay, if it's not like medieval or it's not like some western-ish setting, then it's sci-fi. You know,
right.
New of Arden really is its own thing. We've played around with a lot of different words, but it's not, yeah, it's not sci-fi in a way where it's like about the cosmos. It's not medieval in a way where it's like when I think of a medieval setting, I think about power struggles on like a, like I think of like the Hundred Years' War, you know, and it's kind of like overlaid with fantasy elements maybe sometimes, but basically the kind of like humanity trying to make a bastion for itself or the other, you know, whatever, all that kind of fantasy dynamic has, it gets really varied. I can't really dive into it, I guess, but.
It doesn't have knights. It doesn't have castles. It doesn't have kings and queens.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And there isn't, like you said, the Vancian magic system. You explained that already, but like, doesn't have that, like, this is what I can do on this list and that's it. Like, there's no element of that. I mean, there is a degree of that in terms of like, with New of Arden, you have your disciplines and you can manifest within those disciplines. So if you don't have the discipline, you can't access, you know, the relevant thing. So there's like an element of that limitation, but it's not like, your character has to memorize 10 things and they only do 10 specific things or, you know, and get a new one every other day or whatever. It works. You know what I mean? You just like, yeah, it's all very much dependent on the scene and on the story and on what is available and also what you've spent, so to speak, which I think is represented through our primacy scale system.
Right. But the limitations are only to the type of power you have, not the amount of power you have outside of the primacy. The primacy scale does allow you to boost your power, but you don't lose it without primacy. For example, if you are a sorcerer in 5e and you spend sorcerer points and you use all your sorcerer points, you don't have any more sorcery points for that period. In New of Arden, if you spend all your primacy, you can still do your discipline stuff. You just can't boost it in ways that might be beneficial when needed, but it doesn't completely nerf or what's the word I'm looking for? Cease the effectiveness of what your character can do.
Right. Completely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like there are a lot of systems, you know, I think most systems have some sort of resource to manage. And a lot of the time they have, in the tabletop systems, at least like, or sorry, role playing game systems. I feel like they'll have, you know, like, oh, you spend it and then you can recharge it. And like, and then it's like, yeah, if you don't have it, then you can't do anything.
Right.
You know what I mean? In some capacity. And then again, it's the list concept where it's like, what you can do is still, you know, centered onto this sort of thing, the specific list.
Yeah. Wizard spells.
Like a functions and ability. Yeah, wizard spells or powers or abilities or functions or feats or whatever, you know, all those different words that you'll see. And there's none of that with New of Art. And, you know, you have your blanket concept, like body, you know, what can I do to manifest things that are relevant to the body? And that's it. That's your limit.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about, you know, yeah, the closest thing you'll worry to is like for resources, primacy skill. But again, yeah, it regenerates, it charges. It's a fluid force that you, you know, may find yourself lacking or may find yourself in overabundance even at times. Go ahead, actually.
I was just going to say, I like a resource approach, regardless of what that means, how it's devised, you know, and we lean very heavily into the resources in terms of primacy scale, in terms of armor factors, and what else am I, what am I forgetting? Pretty much everything is a resource, even your your injury scale is based on points lost and points recovered, which is nothing new, but having resources makes things valuable. And we remember when we started, primacy was just there. You had it forever and always.
That's right.
There was no balance. And balance was absolutely necessary because obviously the challenge is what makes it fun.
Yes. Yes. Which was an interesting thing for New of Arden specifically, or well, sort of New of Arden and the fortune system that we're building it on. And it was that like, yeah, trying to find the balance. You know, I think we all in those early moments were seeing a game where you could just kind of make stuff up.
Right.
But then finding out like, wait, you know, how can I affect these dies? What are odds? You know, bringing in that math side, like I talked about earlier, right? And breaking it down further, we realized that while there's certainly functional and fun games with looser, almost barely regulated systems, we found, felt like we hit a sweet spot, or at least the sweet spot we were looking for.
Yes.
With our systems, yeah.
We talked again earlier today about one of the things that I really enjoy about design, and that's finding that balance.
Mm-hmm.
Balance to the point of the perfect tension. So
yes,
you have choices that you can make, and there are good outcomes and there are bad outcomes. In terms of story, you want the outcomes to be harsh enough that they're a challenge to face and consider accepting, but then the reward is great for that, you know, for that sacrifice. And then in mechanical terms, it's like, if you want to be powerful in this way, where are you not powerful? And again, we go back to 5e, something very familiar to people. There is that balance shows up in terms of like the array, as far as character building goes.
Oh, yeah.
You can pick high points in some of these and low points in some of these with your ability scores. And then we end up with dump stats and things like that. Mm-hmm. New of Arden doesn't have a dump stat because we don't have stats.
Right. Yes.
You're always making a choice between this really cool, powerful thing or this really cool, powerful thing. You can't have all the really cool, powerful stuff, but everything that you do get to choose is really cool and powerful.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually a good point. And then we can go back and link again how that interplays with the lore of the world, where, you know, you as a character operating in this land, you know, you are, you know, evolving, actually growing and learning and incorporating and internalizing new powers, really, you know, and you feel that once you hit that mechanically.
Let's talk about what Neo-Varden is then. And it's, so it's not science fiction. It's not medieval fantasy. We did toss around the idea of sort of that dreamscape aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So it ultimately is fantasy because there's not a, I don't know that there's a deeper subgenre without us assuming that we could make up our own, suggest our own subgenre.
Right.
But it is, it has those familiar components. We refer to it as being, elements of Monster Hunter, elements of Castlevania, elements of Avatar, elements of other kinds of examples in popular fiction where there is a an element of unbridled power that also has its limits according to, well, kind of the individual's,
how it relates, you know, like the power can be anything. I mean, in the world itself, the manifestation power can literally be anything. And it's, you know, sort of changed the world in its ways that it did. As a character, it's like, you know, you decide where your character came from, what their life has been up to the point that you're playing them in this adventure. You know what I mean? You kind of decide their motives, what's important to them, who's important to them. And then that shapes how you use your discipline. So like your song discipline, you could be an Asgal, who are the people of aesthetic and song and beauty. And you could look at it from tons of different ways. And even though you will only have the song discipline, the way that those manifestations actually come together and the way you actually engage with the game will be related to how that character was designed in terms of their person. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep. The backstory, the concept that the player has for the character. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say really quick, just so far, I feel like we've seen that. I feel like the characters I've created, you know, I just put together my concept, and then the way that character operates is just natural.
Yes. And then for players or for listeners who don't know, as the character evolves, which is our level up system, there are choices to make about what new discipline am I going to fold into this concept to continue this arc or trajectory of this character's development. And an Asgal with song, first of all, by rule, does not have access to silence, which is the stealthy aspect of the disciplines, but has the choice of mystery or technology or body or mind or element or, you know, there are a lot of choices. Right. But then with each choice comes a limitation on its counter choice. So when you make a new choice, you then make that in exchange for its opposite or its opposition, I guess. And so then you're not, not only are you devising a character build that is flavored very much to the unique person of this character, but you are making agreements that they are not going to be some of these other elements, at least until maximum level.
Right. Which we won't see anywhere else, but it is going to be in the final bit. We've planned up to a max level. You can choose a discipline choose any discipline, basically, no matter if it's in opposition or polar to any other discipline. So that would mean that a character could have primacy, like a primal understanding of body and mind, or silence and song. Eventually, right. And it's the whole journey that brings you to that point of like balance for your character, so they can understand the full dynamic of like a specific kind of thing. It's kind of how I see that eighth level thing.
Or seventh, I guess.
But like the journey is sort of like how, you know, what, like I think of like the Asgal and the, you know, taking an Asgal who would go evolve into body instantly offers a whole different tree of character concept, you know, let alone the abilities, because it's so open-ended. It's not just the abilities. It's also how that character would use as or song and body or a song and mystery, which would be a whole different thing to consider, you know?
Right, right. Do you go more mystical? Do you go more physical?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, yeah, mental or...
Yeah, and like when you create your character, you're not necessarily looking that far ahead. I mean, you could, especially if you're into the power gaming thing. But it almost doesn't really do you any good because... You have to like actually experience, you know, you know what I mean? Like you play a couple evolution one shots or whatever. And you're like, my character is this way, you know, these are, and then you're like, when I evolve, I'm definitely going to go into this thing.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like it's harder to like know how it's going to really go for your character.
Well, yeah, because if you're in a campaign, in New Avarden, especially as your colleagues make their choices, there's a natural tendency to not want to overlap. There's, you know, to look for balance, to look for, to make sure there's a strong cross section of how one character type supports another and things like that. So you may think at the initial development of your character, when I get to evolution five, and I corrected you and I was wrong. It is at evolution eight that you get your fifth.
Okay. Nice.
You're not going to know by the time you're evolution five what your third discipline is going to be, because it depends on what other people are doing. It depends on what your character has realized, unless you are just committed to a build that you've already sat down one night when you were, you know, hanging out watching your favorite program and decided when I build this character from this culture, I'm going to follow this line of disciplines through my evolution all the way to the max. You can do that, and you can choose to ignore the way that things develop with the party. And, you know, that I guess that's probably as close as it gets to power gaming in New Avarden.
Yeah, it really is. And because that's the thing you got to look out for, is I think when you're building any game system, is like, how are the power gamers? What are they going to do when they get a hold of this? You know what I mean? Because those are people typically the ones who are going to, you know, lawyer for things and break things down and truly push the limits, right?
Which is a good thing.
In terms of, yeah, and it is a good thing. It's actually very, very helpful from a design perspective, especially. And I like to have that option, you know, I like the concept of that option because I like to do that. So anyway, with New Avarden, yeah, you can certainly build like an ideal thing, or you can create an image ahead of time. Like, yeah, this is what my character will do and it'll be so cool, you know? But in terms of like the power thing, it's like, you have to be very creative. And at that point, if you're like figuring out ways to combine a couple of disciplines to do really cool stuff, then like you've earned whatever pennies that gets you. Because I feel like, you know, we have enough of the abstract sort of fenced in a certain way to say it, like that, whatever combinations you could come up, whatever things you do put together as a power gamer, you know, sit down. Yeah. You flesh out your evolutions all the way through to the max. And you're like, that's how it's going to go. But even then, like, imagine that the other players at the table would see stuff that is truly unique and really exciting, you know, because this person put all that creative energy into it, trying to be, you know, super powered.
I'm imagining a power gamer looking at this and going, oh, I could totally have that, but I can only have that if I don't get this other thing I totally want.
Yeah, right. Definitely. Definitely. And then being like, ooh, like getting creative with it. Like, ooh, can I mix this and this? Or can I manifest this and the next turn manifest that? You know, like, and just like trying to break that, you know, I feel like is, that's where I would be looking as like from my power gamer's perspective. I'm like, oh yeah, how can I, I gotta do some cool stuff with Earth, affect Earth. You know what I mean? I don't know. What's cool is that that exists in our system and it doesn't tear everything down.
Right, right. And it's because of the scaffold. You know, the structure around the game says, tell me, the seer says, or GM says, tell me what you're trying to accomplish with that action. And is it, you know, is it going to be a status effect or is it going to be an injury effect, basically?
Yeah, right.
And that at its very fundamental form is what the system does. It asks those questions and the player answers them based on their intent. And then it comes out and, okay, is that a one die action? Is that a two die action? How many dice do you have? Can you make enough actions, or do you have to wait till your next turn to follow that up? How long does the first successful effect last? Mm-hmm. Is there enough time for you to bring something else in? Did someone else do something and you want to throw in on that? You know, which is exciting in this system because it allows for those considerations and options. And then if you succeed, your character might throw together or in combination with other characters some pretty dynamic stuff that is really exciting.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because like the game, the way I see it, has a natural reward for creativity in a moment. You know, it's like if you set up something that's going to do like, be like, you know, devastating to an opponent or something, it usually takes that extra thinking outside the box to set something like that up. And it's kind of like, you know, I feel like I said, kind of like rewards it. I don't know how to explain it. But we have like your intent, basically, I think. That's what I wanted to say. You said that word intent. I feel like that's where we've succeeded in this kind of dream or this image that we're putting up. It's like, you know, how do you manage the player's intent? And I feel like we do well with, you know, offering like your intent can be anything, you know, upon this scaffold. And then once your intent is acknowledged and identified, you know, we can decide how it plays out.
And the dice also decide, again, like we were talking earlier, whether or not it happens or something.
Yeah, so then, yeah, totally. We come back to the mechanical aspect, right? We come back to the mechanical aspect, which we agree is sort of like its own separate deal. So we have this system where it's like we're in this world, we're engaging, and I could say, I want to do this. And it can be that flexible, you know, just like, I want to do that. And then we say, well, it's related to this discipline, and it's within the bounds of power, so to speak, and the world's capable, that you're capable of and having as a character. And then you get your dice and you roll them out and you're going for those fours or maybe threes sometimes if you got primacy or you're considering your tactics like in a combat scenario, how you're going to use those dice. And they're your little I don't know. What I call it earlier said, like, get your little dopamine hit on the.
Oh, yeah, your dopamine hit on seeing that.
because like with our system, it's sort of like you have to hit the target number, not like on a scale from like in the 5e, it's like on a 1 to 20 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like you have to land a 4 on your 4-sided die or a 3 and tilt it or whatever, or get doubles. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking for these certain numbers or combinations of numbers. And so. Yeah. And it's somebody satisfying because you're like, okay, you're like, I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do, and I'm just going to see if it works or not. Like, you know, it's intended to be that fluid.
And it works.
Without sacrificing, like, from anything. Go ahead.
It works with the lore because, particularly in New of Arden, because manifesting energy is somewhat unstable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then it's not all just manifestation either. It's not just, you know, manifesting energy is essentially the magic of the world. And I use that word very hesitantly because it's not magic, it's energy. But then there's also things like, you know, just mundane physical or intellectual things like, what do I know about this lore? What do I, you know, how well can I climb? How effective am I at lifting that? How, you know, those sort of mundane things are still possible. And of course they're not actually aspects of this energy that we're talking about. They're just aspects of being alive.
Right.
And so, you know, and that's just kind of an aside, but, what I did want to touch on too is a little bit more about people who are hearing about New of Arden for the first time. It's like, okay, we got this manifesting energy and quote unquote, anything's possible. And I just want to clarify that within the scope, again, of the framework, there is structure there. So it's not like, and we've worked hard and continue to work to make sure that it's not just, you know, any discipline can do anything. We've had to really work on the scaling of that so that there is a sense of uniqueness to the different types of disciplines and limitations between them. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this world. It's like, okay, you tell me about the world. How do I relate to it? Because if there are not knights and there are not castles and there aren't taverns,
Yeah, there's not the usual staples.
Right. So what is there in Newhalvarton? How do people relate to it? How do they identify this world as something they can function in? How would you say?
Well, I would say for me, it's like, for me, I kind of like see it as, how can I, because I, okay, so like I've got a personal interest in like anthropology and stuff like that. And so for me, I see it in the eyes of like these more sort of simplified communities of individuals, like concepts. Like, so for instance, the Asgal, you know, I feel very relatable to them in the sense of like being an artist too is like, I feel that kind of flowy, go with the flow kind of thing that the Asgal kind of are, that like openness, that vulnerability that they offer. I also can relate to the land plaque, you know, for me, personally, I grew up, you know, in the wood, in the mountains, and I'm not, you know, I'm no stranger to working out in the fields and mattocking and building trails and fence posting and all that fun stuff. And I feel that with them too. I'm like, you know, the body, the, what it means to be like boots in the ground and doing honest work, so to speak. It's that kind of like how I feel when I see the land plaque. And you know, the Selkhu who are, they are like of the lore, like they know, they have knowledge, they have just in their heads, and I see the teacher aspect, you know, the archetype, if you will, in that, and I'm like, oh yeah, like I get what they are, and and I see, like, you know, I see myself playing any character or any playable culture, and I also see the world itself, like, I mean, I know this world we live in to be one full of mystery and full of strangeness, and there's all kinds of things that we have answers for, and many more we don't. And that's what Neovar in the world, the plane, so to speak, it offers that kind of like, you kind of know from, you know, having a basic understanding of like things, you know, but really you don't know anything about what's around the corner.
You definitely don't, because the creatures are not well
cataloged. Yes, especially with that.
Unique here. Well, as is the world, you know, the intent of the setting is that it is a place to explore as the players, but that doesn't mean that it's without its knowledge base. So, you know, and I think that just like the game itself is a communal, it's a place where people gather and come together to tell stories and things. In the game, there are places for characters to gather as well. We call them range camps, and it's a concept that fulfills the role of the tavern. Or where, you know, parties meet up, but it puts it in a slightly different context in terms of these are, I don't know, in the tavern, you're going to run into locals, you're going to run into business owners, you're going to run into, you know, all kinds of people who are there for food and drink and entertainment and things like that. Perhaps overnight travelers and things at the range camp. They are very, very critical because they take the place of a whole town. They're a place for some security. They're a place to meet other explorers, to form your bands for exploration, because everyone's got their reasons for being out to explore.
Right.
And you've also generally got trade hubs there as well for the barter. And so they're a huge key component. And given the breadth of the landscape, how many miles there are, of land. There are great distances between villages and other places where some of these things can be procured. So you need these range camps in the middle, and some of them are pop-ups and some of them are more permanent, where explorers gather. And I really love that concept because it takes the question of where do people meet and expands it a little bit in a way that feels different from Yield Tavern. You know, I've had characters meet by hearing a crier on the street corner and calling people over and reading a proclamation, and then they decide there's that way to do it. You can run across each other in the woods, which you could do here in Newhalvarton as well. But the range camp is like, you're still camping. You're still outdoors. You're still setting up your own little space.
Yeah, I think, if you don't mind me jumping in. I feel like I see the range camps as... like if you're going to a range camp or you're at a range camp, like you're out there, you know, you're outside of town and you're beyond the safety of the walls of the Palisades or whatever, you know, home life meant for you. You are now beyond that. Like, and so I feel like every denizen of a range camp or every passersby, you know, whatever, like whoever's there when you're sharing that moment with them, Like, you all have this like unspoken kind of knowledge. Like, you're all out here in the unknown, and you're like in these moments, these little spots are sort of like universal points of safety.
Yeah,
I feel like and rest, like you've mentioned, and trade, and yeah, you know, there's the people there will go there to find people who are looking for things to do, who are looking for adventure. Or, you know, it'll be their adventure to go find that range camp somewhere for whatever they heard about it, you know. Yeah, they're like, they are, you know, they function as these places of meat and stuff. But in a way, they also fulfill a much more important role on a broad scale, like for the people.
Yeah, commerce and safety and exchange of information and... Mm-hmm. So on and so forth. The other aspect that we have that this makes me think of in New Avarden is there isn't a dyed-in-the-wool enmity between cultures. There are some cultures that are more, either in the case of the Kakuts, skittish about other cultures. Mm-hmm. There are cultures such as the Ixia that are indifferent to other cultures. There are some cultures that don't invite people into their villages, but will meet them in other locations, like the oracles for the Selku and things like that.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a variety of ways that the cultures interact with each other that are not all just kumbaya, but they're also not like, oh, this culture does not like that culture. If there's any sort of tension like that, it's within the culture, between the subcultures, and that's primarily it. Now, mm-hmm. New Avarden has factions, because factions are a beautiful part of storytelling. And, you know, when bands of individuals get together with a shared ideal, and then they travel about the land trying to fulfill the objectives of those ideals, that's a faction. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very pleased with the role that factions play in New Avarden, because they add some aspect of tension where there's not the inherent, say, again, with our 5e references, an inherent enmity between this kingdom and that kingdom, or, sure. You know, I suppose that's perhaps the more common. We also don't have a strong theme of servitude or enslavement or anything like that as part of the lore.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily, there are people always mistreat other people, and there is room for that tension, because without tension you don't have story. But it's not a large condition of the world where it is in a lot of other settings.
Yeah, and I honestly, it's one of the things I really appreciate one of the things I really appreciate about the world of New Avarden, because it's like, you know, you're right, like most other settings will have, you know, factions at ends in such a way that it's like equivalent to like war or Cold War, at least, so to speak, you know, that level of tension and distrust. And there's certainly room for that within the lore of the game. You know, there's you could build a campaign around that concept successfully without taking away from this sort of like mutual respect that the cultures largely have with each other. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that turns into an interesting focus, because it's like to you know, from the storytelling perspective, creating an original story from this lore where these cultures are largely respectful to each other, you know, creating the antagonists and stuff. It's like, I want to say it's almost like a unique challenge. It's not that it's a challenge, but I look at the conflicts that, you know, to give to players for the sake of the story, I look at them in a different light. You know, it's,
mm-hmm.
it's less about, you know, we got to stop these bad guys all the time, and right. more about like, we need to understand what's happening. Yeah,
I find that an interesting aspect that we've seen in a lot of our playtests that that are actually out there in the world for people to see if they are interested. Todd Moonbounce, Time Lord's Wife, you know, places that we've done things where we played with players that are people that we just met in the process of setting up these playtests. And what a lot of live stream playtesters are looking for is ways to engage with story that is, there aren't murder hobo-y or hack and slash kinds of situations. And that aligns, speaking of alignment, with New Avarden in terms of not, there not being alignment. Creatures are allowed their own motivations on an individual basis, whether they have a beast level of intelligence or a higher level of sentience, or a lower level. And that gives a lot of freedom to people writing stories for these adventures, because it's not like, there isn't the conflict of like, how bad are my orcs, you know, in this world?
Oh, yeah.
How do my dark elves work? How do my mind flayers work and my vampires and all this kind of stuff, where there's like a lot of controversy about what is evil and what is a bad guy and stuff like that. Mm. And those are questions that we have literally had conversations about. And alignment just doesn't matter as a structure for New of Arden, because a lot of times the conflict is either an aspect of survival between the warring parties, if you will, or the combative parties, hunger and territorialism, you know, in some instances, surprise, fear, normal things that we identify with when it comes to story that aren't driven from categorically good or evil inherent dispositions, if you will.
Because it is like that, you know, and it is, you feel a lot more of that. And like, we know, if when I imagine creating an antagonist from one of the cultures in New of Arden, you know, I do see it like they are on kind of their own driven ideology. You know, it's not like they're from a people who are all like this and they're just the spookiest or whatever, you know. It's like this person has, you know, grew up in this culture, they looked at these things, they looked at the world they share, and they come to this conclusion that's how they're going to operate. You know, it's a whole different motivation, it's a whole different path than something that's like easy, so to speak, like this is the bad people, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Or whatever.
That's because good storytelling is, good storytelling comes from a point of motivation. So your writing instructors will tell you what do your characters want? Every character has to want something. Somebody famously once said, every character has to want something, even if it's just a glass of water. And until they get that object of their desire, there's tension, there's action, there's need. And you can tell a story where someone is just looking at that glass of water from across the room and for some reason can't get to it and strives to achieve it and be in the moment of that tension until somehow their hand finally gets within reach of touching the sweating glass of cold water as their fingertips barely stretch forward, and you're just holding your breath, wondering if they're actually going to get it. That's what it all comes down to for everyone. Whether that glass of water is literally a glass of water or establishing their own center of power for the purpose of what they feel is important for development of the region.
Right. Wow. Yeah, definitely.
And so this is the kind of storytelling that we're kind of trying to encourage, I guess.
Right.
Mm-hmm. More That's question good. About what are the motivators?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which is why I, it's a really nice tie up with how mechanics work with that. And in terms of it being a game, because it's like, you know, we talked about the mechanics and the systems, you know, building your character and how it relates to power gaming. And just like your motives, what your character is about, you know, what took them into the wild to journey, what took them to find other explorers, what took them to pursue this goal of theirs, you know, this motivation. And and that is what defines how they play, like, actually.
Yeah.
You know, because you write all this, you decide all this for your character, you don't even have to write it, you know, it's in your head in some capacity. And then when you're actually playing the game, you're like, oh yeah, I can totally see it being like this, you know, and that's because of all those little other pieces you put before it.
And then as the story unfolds, you cross paths with things that have a different alternative or a different objective. And then the tensions arise naturally.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then in the way you as a player question your character and your character's function is like organic in its way too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have two Leonai in the way they operate different from each other, but you'll see how one kind of will influence the other. Mm-hmm. That's like a maybe more simplified example, but It really is like that, yeah.
It is. It's exciting. Well, so the Leni being the element, the elemental folk, very childlike, very whimsical, kind of don't know their own power. And they meet other Leni, and it's like family reunion all the time, whether, you know, they're, I guess they're theoretically kind of all related anyway, because of their reincarnation aspect.
Right.
And they're all, you know, they're just of the earth. They're of the elements. And so they come and go, bing, bing, and they're always excited to see each other. And they play off of each other, like you're saying. And that is entirely possible. I think it's almost inherent, again, in the system where two Asgall meet each other, or an Asgall Asgard, you know, culture, subculture, however it works, there's a natural dance around each other that happens when these characters engage. We are about to start our first in-home campaign with Nuevarden, and knowing character backstories, we had our session zero and things like that, I can already tell you from the first session, there's going to be that interplay between one of the characters in the party and an NPC engagement, just by virtue of culture to culture recognition and the question that automatically arises for the player and the character of how do I choose to engage with this other semi-familiar face?
Right.
We are already running out of time. Can you believe that? This has been a great conversation. I do want to ask, maybe, what is your favorite thing about Nuevarden?
Ooh, yeah. What is my favorite thing about Nuevarden? You know, I'm honestly, I guess I'm going to be biased about anything I say here, right? But I really enjoy the cooperative elements we've included into the game. So there's like, mechanically, we have this thing called the assist roll, where when it's not your turn, if you have a dice available and somebody else rolls and they didn't get the outcome they wanted, you can roll one of your dice to their success of their action. And it's a really small thing. You know, it's literally just the one option, if you will. But just the way it changes the tactics in the moment, you know, and we've run playtest tables before, you know, we've been seeing this tool frequently in action. And every time is sort of, there's this sort of like uniting moment when it comes out. Even if it's the first time, you know, somebody's tried, okay, I'll try an assist roll this turn. It's just like, oh yeah, you got my back. And you feel it at the table, you know, and you feel that cooperative, like, yeah, we're a group, you know, we're all here for each other. Like, it really ties something together. And like, you know, just that we have something that does that in the game, to me, is really cool.
You make me think of several D&D groups that I've been in where the party did not actively seek that cohesion. There was a lot of, if not outright infighting, a lot of ribbing, chiding, rudeness.
Oh, sure.
And in Nuevarden, you're right. It's designed to support and play off each other. It's not to say that people have to get along if they don't want to, or that there can't be those tensions. So there's nothing about this game says you have to do it a certain way and that's it.
Right. True.
But it does encourage collaboration and overlap and combining, you know, ideas and actions and things like that. We have another rule where if a manifestation is active, you can use your manifestation energy to enhance that active manifestation and turn it over to the person that's burning the first manifestation as it's still active and, you know, things like that. So it asks the players to stay attentive and to look at how they work together much more than just be on your own and deciding if you're going to be pleasant or unpleasant towards everybody else in the group.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's like a sort of built-in way to have direct interaction with each other in pretty much any scene, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just noticed it has like a natural kind of cohesive property to it where like, yeah, people come together for each other.
Right. Yeah. I think that there's a lot built into Nuevarden, probably a lot with every game that people design, where there are aspects of what we appreciate about the game that we want to make sure are highlighted. And what we see in New of Arden and the Fortune system are ways for people to work together and for people to take the reins off of their creativity and not be limited to too much structure. So much that again, you have to point to a list and that's it. Here you get to expand your list, I guess is probably a better way to put it. There is a bit of a list aspect with the framework of the disciplines, but you get to build new things into that list as far as you can imagine them. And then with Seer, work together to determine what those outcomes are.
Right. And then having an answer for the different intentions that you want to fulfill.
Yeah.
You know, and allowing yourself to focus on the intention of what you want to do rather than whether or not that function is available on your list.
Right. Which the limitation is pretty much determined by the type of discipline that you have. So the limitations are there, but they're not within the structure or within the ability of the discipline is a freedom to tweak that discipline a little bit in new ways sometimes if you get an idea.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think the time went by so fast because this is so much fun for us to talk about. Hopefully everyone who was listening enjoyed that as well. And we will be back with guests coming up throughout the summer. We are also going to be attending RageCon at the end of the month in Reno. And looking forward to bringing some U of Arden experience to players at our tables there.
Absolutely. I also wanted to say that you can find, if you're curious about the rules, you want to look them over, we have what I would say is an alpha version of our rules available for download on our website. But stay tuned because we have a whole revamped quick start getting prepped to be shared with y'all. So,
and that's at adventureslang.com. So check us out there. Thanks for tuning in. Aaron, always a pleasure. Talking to you soon.
Yes, talking to you soon for sure. Good chat.